Union, and they've got their propaganda arms, and they push out content, and it all emanates from one sort of central point, one sort of central focus. That has changed. Obviously, those central points are still there. States are still very obviously involved in influencing people, but like they contract out either like both directly and I think also promote indirectly, which is more what we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. People pumping out things that they are that are more or less in their wider shared political interest, right? That are more or less meant to influence people, right? So if this girl is, let's just say this girl is out here making, she know what she's in the military, she's doing her thing, she's attractive, she's shooting guns, she's driving tanks. She's not making content like to make you think that the military sucks. Right. Yeah. She's not like clearly not coming from a perspective of like, hey, don't join the army.
Yeah.
Right. Hey, don't support like American expansionism and like militaristic like interventionism. That's clearly not the position she is taking and trying to promote.
Mm-hmm.
So even if it's more like ostensibly independent, the ideological bent that it's pushing is clearly not.
Yeah. I'm thinking of the term stochastic in this term that has been used, stochastic terrorism, not a direct employment of people to enact terrorism or violence, but a kind of indirect encouraging or gesturing towards the use of terrorism or violence. I almost wonder if we can lift that first word, stochastic, and apply that here. A kind of stochastic propaganda that the algorithms more or less promote this kind of thing indirectly. The propaganda isn't commissioned specifically. There isn't that central organization, but it's kind of action at a distance, as it were.
Just so our listeners know, because that's a great term that you brought up, stochastic. It basically means randomly determined. Having a random probability distribution or pattern that may be analyzed statistically but may never be predicted precisely. And I really like that in terms of stochastic propaganda. I think that's an awesome way of putting it, Brandon, because I also think that it's considerably more advantageous for political movements or the powers that be, because, you know, having propaganda that emanates centrally from one position obviously has benefits. You can have really direct control out of the kind of content that's being promoted, how much of it, where is it going, all this kind of stuff. But it has two primary problems. One is it's very easily knocked out, for lack of a better way of saying it, right? During the Third Reich, the Nazis had the Department of Enlightenment or whatever. They had some hilarious, terrifying name for it. But, you know, this was pumping out all sorts of propaganda. The second, it was over, right? Like, the war was won. That whole institution fell apart and it died, right? Like, it was taken out.
Right.
And it ceased to function properly even before that point for, you know, obvious war-related reasons. The other issue is that it's very hard for a centralized institution like that to make stuff that feels real in the same sort of way, right?
Yeah.
Because it's always considerably more at a distance operating, you know, in the sort of, you know, the guild tower of the authoritarian state. So to effectively promote systems that have citizens or members of a global community or whoever produce that content for you, one makes it much more diffuse, so you do have less control over what people are saying, perhaps very little, but it can't really be knocked out in the same sort of way. It kind of gets into every nook and cranny and just sorts keeps replicating itself.
Yeah.
And two, it comes across as considerably more authentic and genuine and real, because a lot of the times the people pushing the propaganda believe it too, right? Like, it's like they're on there doing their thing, getting out there, commenting a million times on Reddit, on Twitter, blah, 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 pushing all these narratives, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And they're in it. Like, it's like, it's like coming from them.
Yeah, that's their sort of mode of operating, and they go about it.
And I think that that's super interesting and is really very clearly what we're seeing a lot of today, is this sort of like diffuse, stochastic, as you say, propaganda that's much harder, a lot of times is much harder to identify and tame, because it tends to be much, it can be very like unsubtle, but I think generally it is much more subtle.
Yeah.
Right. Kind of on that point, it would be kind of neat if we talked a little bit about, you know, how you and I, we've talked about, you know, both being online and both being in different media areas. You kind of see, we talked about, you said earlier, the classic, you know, one of the foundations of media theory, the medium is the message, or the media is the message. It's very interesting to see in real time how certain media spheres skew very hard one way or the other. And so coming back to the current conflict in Israel and Palestine, I'm on any social media site, it's Reddit. And I will say, from my experience and knowing other Reddit users, that Reddit skews pro-Israel very hard.
Interesting.
And I'm still trying to figure out why exactly that is. But, like, you go on to basically any major subreddit, if it's Israel-Palestine related in any kind of way, the comment sections are immediately going to be a dumpster fire. You can basically guarantee it. But they are very pro-Israel, and people will come on with very pro-Palestinian stances, and they get downvoted into oblivion. Like, I can't count now the number of times I've gone, seen some sort of news article, and, you know, it's about the conflict between Israel and Palestine. And, you know, it just, like, pro-Israel stuff at the top, all super upvoted, then scroll all the way to the bottom where, like, it's kind of like they've pseudo-hidden the heavily downvoted stuff. You have to, like, open it up, and it's where all the really pro, like, Palestinian cause, you know, or, like, anti-Israel or whatever it might be, all that stuff heavily downvoted. And so it's very clear that Reddit's got a very hard bias and skews a certain way and is very much an echo chamber in a different direction. However, I know, I've talked with other people who say that Twitter tends to be the opposite. And so I don't know if you have any ideas as to why you think these certain media outlets, these online media platforms, social media platforms, why they have such a sort of self-sealing echo chamber sort of thing going on within them. Because it's very interesting. It's very obvious, at least from what I see anecdotally. Like, it's like very, it's quite intense. At least I'll say, I'm much more on Reddit. It's quite intense on Reddit. Like, how clearly pro-Israel it is.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, if it, like, if we're trying to explain the difference, it has to, it can only be in reference to their form, because that's essentially what these media are. They are the form of their communication. We were talking, or I alluded a little bit to their differences. Twitter is a bit more imagistic. Images are really suited for tweets, because you just see them in a snap, and then you move on to the next one, and you have the infinite scroll timeline. Whereas on Reddit, you have images and you have links and whatnot, but where the actual communication is happening, because you can do that faster. You can link faster on Twitter. You can post images faster on Twitter. The actual communication that people uniquely rely on Reddit for is their comments, is their long, drawn-out comments. And so maybe there is some difference here between what has to do with the particular sides. I'm not sure. The one thing that I might be able to explain, because I can't explain what is going on Reddit, but I might be able to think about what's going on Twitter in terms of what Twitter is good at. And if it's good at putting out images and spreading things quickly, then that might be, and if it's, if Twitter skews pro-Palestine, then that might be an indication of one kind of rhetorical tactic that pro-Palestinians or even Palestine themselves are relying on, and that is the production of images. And like anecdotally, I have seen a lot of images of the conflict on Twitter, and they're mostly either from the side that is sympathetic to the Palestinians, or they are the employment of Israeli images that are framed negatively, you know, or kind of turned back on them or something like that. And that might just come down to a literal difference in the way that the Israelis and Palestinians produce their kinds of images and propaganda. And they're taking advantage of the form of social media to use that.
So I immediately think of two, I think you're correct. And I think, but I, what's come to my mind is immediately two things as you were speaking. One, speaking, because I'll speak more from the Reddit perspective because I'm on there.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing about Reddit that that is pretty clear is Reddit is self-moderated.
Right.
And so I wonder if, especially for some of the bigger subs where a lot of these things are happening, say talk about news-related, international relations-related subs, world news, these sorts of things, that there might be some skewing of the moderation, basically, that the mods, the people who are in control of these subs, have their own political biases, which then leak into, and this has been a long-standing discussion with Reddit, a long-standing criticism, that because it's self-moderated, because it's self-controlled, you basically have mini power brokers controlling these individual forums, and they can have a huge amount of influence on what is posted and what the style and content and direction of the subreddit actually is.
Yeah.
So that's one side of it. I think another one that I kind of realized as you were speaking is I think Twitter is much more popular in areas that are much more pro-Palestinian, particularly in places like the Middle East, Africa, the Indian subcontinent, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Where I think, from my understanding, I think that Twitter has a much larger user base in those areas, whereas Reddit is skews very Western. It skews very North American, European, which it generally, obviously, there's, even within our own communities, there's an enormous amount of split in people's sort of alignment with this issue, just like any issue.
Yeah.
But especially such a hot issue like this. But generally speaking, those places skew more pro-Israel.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so I think we might also be seeing that sort of demographic difference playing out within the context of these forums. Because obviously there's people for everywhere on Reddit.
Yeah.
But because it's so, and this comes back to what you're saying, because it's so comment emphasized, right?
Yeah.
Reddit is enormously about the comments and the discussion. If you're not well versed in English, then it's not like a super ideal space for you. Obviously, there's other subreddits that are in all sorts of different languages,
but it
is heavily skewed English in terms of that sort of the medium and the medium's content comment aspect of it.
Yeah. Whereas its form of communication is linguistic.
Twitter as well as Instagram are effectively very imagistic.
Yeah.
They're very emphasized on the image, on the video, and that is much more shareable regardless of people's particular position and linguistic situation.
Yeah.
And so I think we might actually be seeing those demographics playing out within them and particular forms of, like, the medium's sort of dictating that, you know, Reddit's comment heavy emphasis, that discussion heavy emphasis, it generally in English, really precludes a lot of internet, like, non-Western involvement.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you point out the demographics specifically with Twitter, because I know that Twitter is really big first hurrah in terms of spreading awareness of movements was the Arab Spring. So Twitter has had an involvement with the Middle Eastern world for basically its entire existence.
I mean, it specifically traveled for quite a while around Ethiopia, and which unfortunately is also in a very serious conflict right now as the world seems to kind of go a bit ablaze.
Yeah.
But it's not something we hear a lot about. That's a whole other discussion in terms of how media sort of picks and chooses what it's going to promote and focus on. But Unfortunately, they're effectively and have been in a civil war for a number of years now. But when I was there, I was very interested to learn that for much of Africa, Ethiopia included, the internet is basically Facebook. Like Facebook is what everybody uses. And Facebook is used for everything from searching up info to communicating with people to selling stuff, which we do here as well.
Yeah.
But from talking to people who are actually living there, it was really emphasized that nobody actually goes online, right? Nobody goes to Google and hits a search engine and starts looking stuff up. Everybody basically stays on Facebook, and that is their online world.
That's
interesting.
And it's
very contained within that structure.
Hmm.
And so you see those demographic differences on what areas are really overemphasized particular platforms over others. Warfare is on the rise. Basically, conflict is on the rise. There's an enormous amount of dissatisfaction internally in Western governments or in Western populaces with their states and their sort of traditional organization. And it's a period that a lot of analysts, and there was a discussion around a lot of concern for the direction that things were going. And I wonder what your sort of thoughts roughly are on that. And I know you and I both actually watched a piece of media that kind of directly relates to or reflects this sort of shift.
The video you're referring to is the speech that the El Salvador president, Nayib Bukele, gave at CPAC very recently. And it was interesting to watch it. The content of the speech itself is worth thinking about, worth considering. But from a media perspective angle, I also noted that I'm watching this on YouTube. YouTube has comments, so I'm going to go look at the comments. And a lot of the comments are quite celebratory. There is not so much... If social media was the even playing field that we thought it was, there would be a lot of people who were for or against this or something like that. That does not seem to be the case. A lot of people seem to be celebratory of this almost exclusively. I found one or two comments of people who were concerned about this, but more or less the things that I saw of people discussing this are, this is great. We should have this here because this is a Salvadorian president addressing an American, conservative American audience. So it's a lot of people in the comments saying, yes, we should have this here. But the other thing that I found was interesting was that a lot of people were saying, you won't see this in the mainstream news media. This guy's got to watch out. He's saying things to people who are listening, so I found that was very interesting. But specifically in reference to go to what he's talking about, it makes sense that this would be the kind of reaction, one, he is addressing in the video a conservative audience, but also he's addressing a conservative audience as a president who has come in and really, as we say, gotten stuff done. He has come in and more or less taken it upon himself to enact very sweeping motions in his country.
Yeah, just to elucidate a little bit about who this person is, he's been in the news quite a bit. Nayib Bukele, he's the, like Brennan was saying, the president of El Salvador. But basically, the long and short of it is, he's such a hot person right now in the political field because El Salvador, up until relatively recently, was effectively a very seriously gang-controlled country. Nobody is denying that. It had one of the highest murder rates in the entire world. Very, very violent, cartels and gangs basically ran the country.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very scary situation. He took over and effectively suspended the Constitution and used the state power to basically imprison anyone that was even affiliated with the gangs, take them all out, completely dismantle them, destroy them. And El Salvador has had like, here's the thing. We cannot deny that what he has done has had a enormous positive impacts on the day-to-day lives of everyday people. And he is genuinely extremely popular.
Yeah.
Within El Salvador and internationally for a lot of people because of what he's done. He's really turned the fortunes of the country around, but has done so using very classically authoritarian contexts. And the speech at the CPAC was very interesting because it basically was a warning slash advocacy for like doing what needs to be done so that you don't fall apart. Basically saying, you know, El Salvador had all these liberal, stupid policies that led to, you know, the gangs taking over and nobody wanted to deal with it and everybody was too scared and everyone was super corrupt. And so we had to come in and basically, like, for lack of a better way of saying it, like, kick some ass. And that's what you're going to have to do too, is basically the message.
Yeah.
And people were stoked, in the crowd. People were stoked. It's a very interesting message. It's also a very concerning message. It's interesting because of how popular it's becoming again.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen this rise of sort of people's interest in strongmen, for lack of a better way of saying it. And he is a very popular strongman. But there's also this, but strongmen only really make sense within the context of societies that are incredibly dissatisfied with the status quo.
Yeah.
And are incredibly concerned with the direction, like with their national and communal direction, and need to get back on track. And so it's really interesting to see this sort of rhetoric and position and political ideology like really take hold again and be really popular. Obviously, Trump is the American example of this.
Yeah.
I'll be honest, like Nayib Bukele is considerably more like eloquent and relatable than Trump, but it's the same sort of like structure. And Trump has really emphasized this as well as being like, you know, what did he say? Like, somebody asked him, are you going to be a dictator? And he said, no, but maybe for basically like, but maybe for the first few days, basically being like, you know, if you want to clean up, you got to get your hands dirty.
Yeah.
Right. Like, and that's really like, and there seems to be a lot of people who are like, okay with that sort of messaging.
Yeah.
It's very interesting, for lack of a better way of saying it.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's interesting in that when you put it on the table and you look at what you've got here, it's very concerning and it is very reminiscent of previous instances in history, especially if we've sort of forgotten about how these things really came to be and we just have the memory of what happened. But it's interesting in that it is taking that form specifically of... you know, we have previous authoritarians and dictators who left enormously terrifying legacies and have left memories of being these feared and dangerous beings. But in the rise of those positions, in the rise of those people, they got there through mass endorsement. Political power is given through endorsement and the consent of people in this way.
Well, and frightening political power is in particular, and like, and you know, maximized power, it comes through political endorsement, it comes through populism. You know, it's one thing for, you know, an oligarchy of very distant individuals to control things behind the scenes, past feudal systems and stuff, where you have a very small clique of people who kind of run the show and just kind of own everything. Specifically talking about like past movements, like, you know, fascist movements and stuff like that. We have this like general view of them now as being these kind of like ridiculous, evil, terrible characters who are like suppressing everyone. The first part's kind of true, but the second part is not true in the sense that these regimes were very, very, very popular.
Yeah.
With their own people. People really believed, people really liked, people like Mussolini, people like really, the German populace in general for quite some time really liked Hitler. He was extremely popular and they liked him on a personal level. That in itself is a structure that I kind of see quite a bit more with these sort of authoritarian leaders than this sort of more establishment candidates. Nobody really likes Joe Biden. And he's like, astute. People love Trump.
Yeah.
Right? People love Bukele. People, we can think of it that way. People in Russia, many Russians love Putin. Like, yeah, they are personally invested in his personage as, you know, the leader of their country, state, and people. And this is a very, this sort of reverence is very interesting, and it's very much sided on the more pro-authoritarian, conservative, aggressive, if you want to just call out sort of neo-fascist type movements that we're seeing. Mm-hmm. And it's also a key component. It's always been a key component to their success.
It's interesting to see this play out in terms of, just to bring it into our social media, or to wonder about the role that social media has been playing in this, let's call it a new wave of authoritarian personality, that there is so much about social media that emphasizes not just the authenticity or anything like that, but the profilicity, the character or the characterological aspect of any given user and the way that you navigate social media. It's one thing to say that these politicians are just enormously powerful TikTok celebrities. They might be the equivalent of that, but in relation to all the other people on social media as well, what sort of profilicity, what sort of branding does that allow users to take on, and does that have anything to do with the way that these people attain political power and political personae?
Well, thank you all for listening, and this has been the Canadian Philosophy Show, and we hope you'll join us next time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.